Ever get that feeling like you want to like really get something, you know? Like really understand it, dig deep down, but then the thought of all the stuff you got to go through to get there, all the info and everything, it's just overwhelming.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
That's kind of what we're tackling today. We're going deep, deep dive style into something that, well, it shapes everything, right? Our relationship with time.
It really does.
And to help us unpack all this, we've got the brilliant thinking of Oliver Berkman. He wrote 4,000 Weeks, and he used to write for The Guardian, too.
Right. And he spent a lot of time thinking about, well, productivity, for one, and what it actually means to be human. Big questions.
Big, big questions. And for this deep dive, we've got, well, a really interesting mix of his work to draw from. We're going beyond just the book, 4,000 Weeks, although that's in there too, of course. But we've also looked at some of his conversations on YouTube. He had some really insightful chats with Dr. Rangan Chatterjee, who's
Oh,
fantastic.
those are great.
And then there's the stuff he did with Martin Sketchley, the podcaster, and his appearance at Nudgestock in 2024. Lots to
A
cover.
real range. So yeah, we're aiming to distill all that, give you the essence of his ideas without you having to spend hours and hours,
Yeah,
you know.
exactly. That's the mission here, to pull out those core ideas, the heart of what he's saying from all these different places, like how we experience time, this thing we have with productivity, facing the fact that, well, we aren't here forever. And ultimately, how do we live a life that feels, I don't know, meaningful, knowing that our time is limited?
Yeah.
And it's important to say right off the bat, this isn't about like squeezing more into your day. It's deeper than that. We're going way deeper into how we relate to time itself. Big picture stuff.
Absolutely.
So hopefully there'll be some aha moments in here for you, our listener. All right, so where do you even start with something as huge as time, right?
Right. It's massive.
Well, Berkman starts with something pretty straightforward, but also kind of a punch in the gut. It ends. It's finite.
Yeah, that's it. The title of his book, right there, 4,000 Weeks.
Yeah.
Just seeing that makes you think. And he talks about this in his interview with Dr. Chatterjee about how that number, even though it's an average, rounded figure,
Yeah.
you know, lifespans are all different lengths, but the point is,
Makes you stop.
it makes you stop and think because it's not forever.
And there's a story he tells from his talk at Nudgestock. It really struck me. He was asking his friends, hey, take a guess. How long is the average human life, but in weeks? And one person, totally off, guessed like 150,000 weeks.
Wow.
Way off. But then Berkman does this amazing comparison. He's like, okay, even if you double that crazy number, that's still basically the whole of human civilization from ancient Mesopotamia to now.
Right.
Suddenly, all the time we get, it feels incredibly tiny, doesn't it?
It really does. And that's exactly what he's getting at. Like, it's this undeniable truth, but we don't live like it most of the time. We act like our time is limitless. We put things off, the things that really matter.
Yeah.
And in that interview with Chatterjee, he emphasizes this. It's like, we've got forever.
And that can make you anxious too
Right.
when you really let that reality sink in that it's not forever. Berkman talked about this with Chatterjee. There's that initial feeling like, oh no, I got to do everything now, squeeze every bit of value from each day. It's almost exhausting to even think about.
Oh, it is. And that's the thing, that initial panic. It
Yeah.
means we haven't really understood deep down what it means to have limited time.
Yeah.
Berkman's trying to gently get us to this other place, like accepting the boundaries, you know,
Yeah. Yeah.
that there will always be more to do, more things to chase, more things we should be doing, but we can't. And that's where the con comes in, the freedom, when you accept that.
Okay, so let's get more into that. Accepting limits. I feel like it connects with another big point he makes, you know, that it's kind of pointless to try and be totally in control of your time and this thing we do, trying to clear the decks before we can actually focus on what matters.
Oh, yeah, the decks. He talks about that a lot with Martin Sketchley. It's like so many of us are always reaching for that feeling of like, I'm on top of it all, got everything under control. But the thing is, our lives are finite, like we said. But the things that demand our time, they just keep coming. It never
It's
ends.
never ending. And I fall into this trap all the time. You start the day, you're thinking, okay, I'll just power through these little things, get to inbox zero, then I'll have this beautiful, clear space for the important stuff. But you know what? Those decks, they never get clear.
Never. And here's the thing, and he says this both to Sketchley and in 4,000 Weeks, the more you try to clear the decks, the faster they fill up again.
Yeah.
Because you're answering every little thing right away, so you're just inviting more and more.
Oh, interesting. Like you're almost signaling, hey, I've got tons of space for more.
Exactly.
So if trying to control everything and clear the decks is like a losing battle, what do we do instead? It sounds like Berkman's saying we need to change how we approach each day from the ground up.
Yeah, exactly. He suggests starting your day by, you know, making time. An hour, maybe two. Doesn't have to be huge. But dedicate that time to something you know is really important. Like really moving forward on something that matters to you.
Okay.
And then later, you can have a set time for all the smaller things. But don't expect to finish them all. He has this great analogy he uses with Sketchley. It's like the difference between gardening and climbing a mountain.
I like that.
Climbing a mountain, you get to the top, it's done, you achieved it. Got a garden.
Yeah.
It's an ongoing thing. You're always tending to it, always stuff to do. And our to-do lists, they're much more like gardens. You got to look after them.
Yeah.
But they're never truly done.
I love that analogy. Takes the pressure off, right? Not feeling constantly behind. Okay, another big idea he digs into is the whole saying no thing. We hear this all the time, right? But he's got a deeper take on it, doesn't he?
He does. In the interview with Dr. Chatterjee, he talks about how it's not just about saying no to the things you don't like or that don't work for you. You got to learn to say no to things you actually want to do. It's kind of a paradox.
It does feel kind of backwards. Because you think, oh, if I just get better at saying no to the bad stuff, then my life will be all the things I love. But he's saying it's not that simple.
Not that simple at all.
Yeah.
Because there are always going to be so many possibilities, things you're interested in, even things that feel urgent.
Right.
More than you could ever fit into your life.
Right. More than a lifetime. He talks about existential overwhelm, right?
Yes. It's that feeling when you realize there's just so much you could be doing. But then the reality is we have limited time. And it's stressful, it's anxiety producing, so many good causes, fascinating places, skills you could learn. You can't do it all.
You can't.
And that's the thing. You have to accept that and then choose something meaningful and focus on that, not try to do everything and just burn out.
It almost feels like it makes that FOMO feeling worse, you know, fear of missing out with all the stuff we see online, all the experiences and potential things we could be doing.
Oh, totally. And Berkman talks about this with Dr. Chatterjee. The internet, social media, all of it, it just amplifies that feeling.
Well,
you're constantly bombarded with these perfect little snippets of amazing lives and experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And the algorithms, they're designed to show you stuff you're interested in, right? Mm-hmm. So it's even harder to ignore.
It gets targeted FOMO.
It really is. And he also talks about how it's not just personal stuff. The internet shows us so much suffering in the world, so much injustice. You feel like you should be doing something. Like a moral obligation. But no one person can fix it all.
You can't.
He makes this point. Even the most compassionate people in history, they didn't have to see all the suffering that we do every single day. So of course you want to help. That's human. But thinking you can fix it all, it's not realistic.
Leads to burnout.
And feeling paralyzed and guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Not really helpful.
It's interesting how this leads into something else he talks about. The efficiency trap. This one really made me rethink some of my own, you know, ways of working.
Oh, yeah. That's a fascinating one. He brings this up at Nudge Stock. It's like this paradox. You try to be more efficient thinking you'll free up more time.
Right.
But it can actually end up creating more work.
Right.
And you just feel busier.
Yeah.
Because you're so efficient, it's easier for more demands to come in.
It's like you're making space for them. And he uses email as the example.
Perfect example.
Yeah.
So you're super on top of your inbox, answering everything lightning fast. What happens?
More emails.
Tons more emails.
Mm-hmm.
People know you'll respond right away, so they email more. You get known for being super responsive, which just brings in more messages.
You're training people.
You are. He even talks about like almost a productivity hack, being a little slower with your emails. Sometimes things just sort themselves out or someone else takes care of it.
Amazing.
It is. And then at Nudge Stock, he had this other interesting historical example about labor-saving devices in homes.
Oh, right.
Like washing machines, vacuum cleaners. Back in the early 1900s, those came in. And people thought, oh, this will free up so much time for women.
Right, of course.
But it didn't really work out that way. He talks about Ruth Kellen's book, More Work for Mother. What happened was the standards for cleanliness went up.
Oh, right.
So women were often doing just as much housework, just to a higher standard. The efficiency just raised the bar.
So you're not really saving time. You're just doing more. Better.
Exactly. It's a bit of a vicious cycle. And then kind of the opposite of all this obsession with speed and being efficient. Berkman talks about patience, which feels almost radical these days.
It does.
At Nudge Stock, he actually calls it a superpower in this world that's just getting faster and faster.
Yeah.
He even quotes Nietzsche, who back in the 1800s was already talking about people thinking with a watch in hand, even when they were eating.
Wow. It's so true. Our lives are so fast-paced, but then we get impatient with the things that are still slow, you know, waiting for the microwave, a web page to load.
Right. And he mentions this study. It's a bit unsettling. People would rather give themselves electric shocks than just sit there and be bored. It shows how uncomfortable we are with just, you know, the natural rhythm of time.
That's a wild.
It is. And so he contrasts this with this exercise. It's by this art historian, Jennifer Roberts. Her students had to spend 3 whole hours looking at one piece of art. And in that first hour, people hate it. It's this fight against not being able to control the pace, to just be there. But then Berkman actually did this exercise himself with this painting, Cotton Merchants in New Orleans. And he's like, if you push through that initial feeling, you start to see things you would have totally missed if you were rushing. You get a much deeper understanding.
It's like slowing down lets you actually see more. And this applies to more than just art, right?
Oh, yeah. He connects it to things like problem solving, even reading. Mm. When you try to rush it, you actually don't get as much out of it. So this brings us to embracing limits, right? And this funny term he uses, the joy of missing out. JOMO. Yeah, he talks about this with Martin Sketchley. He's saying, missing out, it's not something to be scared of. It's just part of life, part of having limited time. Every choice you make to do one thing, you're also choosing to miss out on a ton of other things.
It's unavoidable, right?
It is. So instead of dwelling on what we're not doing, he's suggesting that we choose how to spend our time and really own that choice, knowing we're missing other stuff, but that's okay. Yeah. And that can actually make the experience we're having even more meaningful.
Like you're more present because you've made that choice.
Exactly. It's the power of intention. And in that interview with Chatterjee, he points out how we're always making choices about our time, whether we realize it or not. The real freedom isn't actually being aware of those choices, like deciding what really matters now, not feeling bad about what we're not doing.
No guilt.
No guilt. And then he gets into something really interesting, challenging how we usually think about productivity. Even the idea of time as a resource. I know for me, books like The 4-Hour Workweek, they had a big impact on how I thought about time, like something to manage carefully. But Berkman has a different view, right?
Oh, totally. He does acknowledge how that way of thinking can be helpful at first, to be more mindful of your time. But he thinks it can become a problem. In the Chatterjee interview, he says something really thought-provoking. It's like, we don't actually have time, like it's some possession. But we are time, right? Our lives are made of time.
Yes. And it's a subtle shift, but it's huge. It's not something separate that we're trying to control from outside. It's us.
We are time.
And that constant focus on using your time well to achieve some goal in the future, it can actually stop you from being present now.
Yeah.
And enjoying the things you're doing just for themselves.
Yeah.
Even has this weird paradox, as he calls it. You almost have to be willing to waste time to actually use it well, like not using it for some specific outcome.
That's really interesting.
It's about being in the moment. And that brings us to something that's all over Berkman's work, the importance of presence.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, he connects this to stuff from Buddhism and Zen too.
Yeah.
Just being present with your time, being in the moment, like really there. He keeps saying, our life is time. It's not something we own. Mm-hmm. And there's this great observation from his friend David Kane. When we say things like, oh, I've got 3 hours to do this, what we really mean is, I hope nothing unexpected comes up. It shows how little control we actually have over the future.
We're assuming it'll all go smoothly.
Right. And that's never guaranteed. So it's about focusing on now instead of trying to control what hasn't happened yet.
Okay, let's talk about something we all struggle with, procrastination.
Yeah.
What's Berkman's take on why we put things off?
Well, he thinks it's often because we're trying to avoid facing our own limits. Subconsciously, I mean.
So subconsciously, okay.
Like, say you're putting off writing something. Maybe deep down, you're afraid of not being good enough or not having enough time. Or what if people don't like it?
So it's like self-protection.
Exactly. You're protecting yourself from those bad feelings. And perfectionism is the big part of it, too. Because if you don't start the project, it can stay perfect in your head.
That's so true.
But as soon as you start, you have to deal with reality. It's messy and you're human, so you make mistakes.
I can't live up to that ideal version.
Right. And then he also talks about something that we don't always think about. The good side of limits, even limits we set for ourselves.
Interesting.
He gives this example of the band Crowded House. They would deliberately limit what instruments they could use when they were writing songs to be more creative.
Wow.
And he's saying, recognizing that time is limited, instead of always fighting it, it can actually help you be more focused and effective. Mm. And this is where the Sabbath thing comes in.
Oh, right. This idea of creating those boundaries, times for rest. It really feels important, especially in a world where it feels like anything is possible anytime.
It does. He tells this story about a Jewish family observing the Sabbath. And it made me think about, like, carving out that time for rest. It could be so powerful.
And creating those rhythms.
Yeah. He contrasts this with the whole digital nomad thing. Mm-hmm. You know, having no set schedule, being able to work anywhere. It sounds great, but it can get lonely and mm-hmm. there's no structure.
No grounding.
Right. And then he even questions this whole idea of wasting time, which we usually see as a bad thing.
Yeah, totally.
He actually says that time spent just being, maybe not doing anything specific, can be so valuable and enjoyable, even if it doesn't lead to some concrete outcome. He has this story about someone who thought they'd failed their driving test, so they relaxed.
Oh, right.
And then they ended up doing really well. It shows how sometimes not trying so hard for a specific result can actually be better.
It's letting go of the pressure, the expectation.
Exactly. It's about enjoying the moment for what it is. And then there's this other concept, the Shabbat elevator. Have you heard of this?
No. What is that?
It's this elevator. It's programmed to stop on every floor automatically during the Sabbath. In Jewish tradition, you're not supposed to operate machinery then.
Oh, I see.
It sounds kind of crazy, right?
Yeah.
But Berkman uses it as a metaphor. Like, we need those really obvious external things sometimes to make us stop.
We're so used to going, going, going.
Yeah, and we think we can control it all. But sometimes you need to be forced to stop.
Yeah.
And then as we're starting to wrap up this deep dive, I wanted to mention something he says about enlargement over happiness. It's about making big life choices.
Oh, yeah, that's a good word.
He's talking about the work of this Jungian psychologist, James Hollis. And he says, don't just focus on what will make you happy right now. Ask yourself, what will make me grow? What will enlarge me?
Mm.
And he makes this point that we're not very good at predicting what will make us happy in the long run.
We think we know, but we don't.
And the things that really mean something, they don't always feel good in the moment. Sometimes they're hard. And another thing he says that really stuck with me, the future will never provide the reassurance you seek from it. That's deep.
Oh, that's a good one.
It's a central idea from his last piece in The Guardian, and he talks about it in Nudgestock too. Like, if you're always worrying, always planning, trying to be certain about the future, you can never really get there.
Mm-hmm.
Life is full of surprises, and anything can happen. Wanting that reassurance just makes you more anxious.
Keeps you from living now.
Right. He says we have to accept the uncertainty and be curious about the future instead of trying to control it.
Embrace the unknown.
Yeah. And he also touches on this idea of the happiness of the unknown.
Okay. What's that about?
Well, he suggests that a lot of really happy people are probably the ones we've never heard of. You know, they're not famous. They don't need everyone to know about them. It's kind of a subtle critique of, like, the whole social media thing.
Oh, interesting.
Where everyone's trying to build a public image.
Trying to be seen.
Exactly. And then he brings it all back to the importance of doing things now. Like, actually taking action.
Not just thinking about it.
Exactly. If you want to do meaningful things, you have to do them now. Not wait for that perfect moment in the future when you're ready. He talks about this idea of paying yourself first with time. It's from this creativity coach, Jessica Abel.
Okay.
And it's about setting aside time for the things that matter most now, even if you haven't finished all the other stuff.
Making it a priority.
A priority. And he mentions those great quotes. You know, Carl Jung says, you only need to do the next most necessary thing. And Anna from Frozen, she's got this simple wisdom. Do the next right thing. It's all about focusing on this moment, not getting lost in what might be.
One step at a time.
One step at a time. And even Berkman's own life, you know, he moved from Brooklyn to the North York Moors.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a direct result of thinking about all this. He wanted a slower, more intentional life, even if it wasn't always convenient.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into all this, what would you say is the most important thing you want our listener to walk away with?
I think the core message, the most empowering one, is that accepting our limits, that our time is finite, we're human, it's not about giving up. It's a way to live a more meaningful life with less stress and more fulfillment. It's about knowing you can't do it all, being okay with saying no, understanding that the more efficient you are, the more work you might get, finding the strength to be patient, and doing things now, in this moment, that align with what you really care about.
That's beautifully put, a perfect way to sum it up. So, listener, here's a final thought for you to chew on. Think of just one thing you've been putting off, something that really matters to you or just brings you joy. What's one tiny, almost insignificant step you could take towards it today? Knowing that you probably won't get everything else done. See how that feels, that tension between all the stuff you should be doing and the reality that you only have so much time.
We all have that tension.
We do. We really hope this deep dive has given you some good food for thought, a new way of looking at time and how we live. Maybe it'll even make you want to explore Berkman's work more on your own.
There's a lot to explore there.
So much. Until our next exploration.